Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, my people, and welcome to the show. This is Splash, and my pond is open. We have a great show for you tonight. We have a lot to talk about, lots on tap, so much to cover, and so little time to do so in just one info-packed hour. The number to call is 215-383-5730. That's 215-383-5730. And I encourage you to jump right in, wade carefully if you must. But remember, in my pond, everyone swims at their own risk. We'll be here for the next hour doing the thing I love to do most, talking smack about politics. We now have a blog, so all of our shows are posted there, past, present, and future. Just go to 1111broadcasting.com, and you can listen to a show, make comments and suggestions, or just say hi. You can also follow me on Facebook at 1111broadcasting. Facebook is new to me, so I'm looking for friends. Go on over there, and however they define a friend, you can be my friend, and I'll friend you back, I promise. If you miss a show, don't sweat it. The show links are right over there on the blog, so just go to 1111broadcasting.com. You can jump right into the show chat room tonight. You'll need a free login from Blog Talk Radio. It takes less than a minute. Put in your email address, pick a screen name, a password, and voila, you can jump right into the show chat room. Pick on people, pick on me, or just say hi. Of course, you don't need to create an account to call. Just call the number right there at the top of the show page. It's 215-383-5730, and I would love to talk to you. Put me to the test. It'll be your time to shine. Anyway, lots happened today in the news, and I'm sure, but once again, just like last night, what a busy day for me. So I did peruse the blogosphere, and I did look a little bit at the news. So we'll see where that takes us tonight. The number to call, 215-383-5730, 215-383-5730. If there's a topic I'm not covering, just give me a call and bring it up. We'll make mincemeat out of it. Before we get into the show, let me tell you about Choice Mattress and Furniture. When it comes to mattresses and bedding, David Ritter and his staff at Choice Mattress and Furniture know their stuff. I took my family to Choice Mattress, and everything was considered, from our weight to our age to even the way each of us sleeps at night. The right mattress was personally selected for each of us. Now my whole family sleeps in great comfort all night long on beds from Choice Mattress, and yours can too. Every mattress carried by Choice Mattress comes with a 5, 10, or even 15-year 100% full replacement warranty, not a prorated limited warranty like some other stores. Chances are that if you bought a bed in the Daytona Beach area in the last 20 years, then you bought it from David. With over 20 years of experience, David knows beds, and you should see all of the other fine lines of furniture Choice Mattress has for every room in your home. Go see David and the fine folks at Choice Mattress and Furniture, located at the corner of LPGA and Nova Road, 1501 North Nova Road in Holly Hill. If you just have questions, give David a call. He'll be happy to answer those. 386-226-BEDS. That's 386-226-2337. Choice Mattress, simply the best choice you can make in your sleep. Got to tell you, folks, I just don't know where to start tonight. There is so much going on, so many fires here, there, and everywhere. So I think I'll go ahead and just jump across the Atlantic Ocean first thing, because millions of copies of Charlie Hebdo sold out within minutes this morning. They under threats of death and more attacks and all of that, defiantly, or should I say courageously, came out with their next issue. The satirical magazine announced last week that it would continue with its weekly publication, increasing its printing to 3 million copies. Now, folks, they normally only print about 500,000, I think it is. So 3 million copies, they knew what was going to go on, and seems to me they should have printed even more. Of course, you know the caricature of the Prophet Muhammad is on the cover. It sold out before the sun even came up. That's more than 50 times its normal circulation. Oh, so they actually only print about 50,000 copies normally. So, and they have millions more copies expected to arrive. So 3 million was just their first printing. Survivors of last week's attacks, during which 17 Parisians were killed and many from the magazine, worked in borrowed offices to continue working on this week's issue. The cover features a tearful Muhammad holding a sign that reads, "Je suis Charlie." That's, of course, "I am Charlie," a line that has been invoked since the January 7th attacks to show worldwide solidarity with the publication and the support for free speech. The image appeared below the headline, "All is Forgiven." Awesome, awesome cover. Now, of course, speaking of free speech, however, we have to consider the other side, because there's a French comedian, Duendon, he's to stand trial over a Facebook post about the Paris attacks. The only thing I could find on this was the French comedian will face trial over a controversial Facebook comment he wrote in the wake of the extremist attack in Paris. Agents, they have a report on that that you can click over on Huffington Post. A judicial source told the news service that the comedian will stand trial for condoning terrorism. Well, you know, folks, I mean, this is a rock and a hard place here, because we are in all this strong solidarity for the and support of free speech, and yet here's a guy that's being taken to task and actually to stand trial criminally for exercising free speech. Of course, France has ordered prosecutors from around the country to crack down on hate speech, anti-Semitism, and those glorifying terrorism. So this is actually part and parcel of their policy ever since the attacks. The authorities say that 54 people have been arrested for hate speech and defending terrorism since the terror attacks killed 20 people in Paris. That included, of course, the three gunmen, whom I'm sure nobody really cares about. The crackdown came as the newspaper, of course, Charlie Hebdo, defiantly sold out its new issue around Paris. So interesting contrast there between what you're allowed to say and what you're not allowed to say. Of course, say over here, an ISIL sympathizer, I call him ISIS because I don't like this whole Levant thing, but ISIS sympathizer was arrested in a plot to attack the U.S. Capitol. It's an Ohio man who apparently proclaimed his allegiance to ISIS and was arrested Wednesday in connection with a plot to attack the U.S. Capitol using guns and pipe bombs. Man, there's a lot of nutbags out there. His name is Christopher Lee Cornell. He's 20 years of age of Green Township, Ohio. He was charged with attempted killing of a U.S. government official and with possession of a firearm in furtherance of an attempted crime of violence, according to the complaint that was filed in the federal court in Cincinnati. The arrest came as he was making his final preparations to carry out the attack and after he bought two semi-automatic weapons, along with about 600 rounds of ammunition, according to an FBI agent supporting the complaint. Interesting development right here in the United States. Now, of course, then we've got a boneheaded ex-congressman, Republican, a former Republican from Illinois, Congressman Joe Walsh. Apparently, he posted a very controversial tweet on Monday calling for networks who chose not to run an image of the first cover of Charlie Hebdo after the Paris terror attacks. So he was basically saying, of course, you know, the latest cover had the, we already said, had the what was on the latest cover. He slammed those who didn't show the cover, saying that they should be attacked next. In other words, here we are with all this solidarity with regards to free speech and over this attack on a newspaper. And he's basically saying the next ones that should be attacked are the newspapers that didn't show the new Charlie Hebdo cover. His tweet said, "Let's hope that when the Islamists next strike, They first behead the appeasing cowards at CNN, MSNBC, et al., who refuse to show the cartoons. Now, I will tell you, folks, it is true. A lot of these places came out and they showed the cover, but either the picture frame wasn't exactly centered, or they had other newspapers covering the cartoon, or somebody was holding the newspaper so that their hand was covering the cartoon, or maybe even the newspaper was folded in half, and therefore the cartoon was below the fold, to use newspaper jargon. But bottom line is that's neither here nor there. That's some tweet to wish that kind of thing on somebody. Excuse me, folks, while I talk to my daughter, because I do this show, of course, as you know, from my home. Hold on one moment, please. Savannah, what would you like? What can I do for you? Yeah, I'm sorry, baby, but you're going to have to adjust the shower water all on your own, okay? And now the whole world knows that you're taking a shower. Isn't that cool? All right. Maybe you can take your naked little 4-foot body into the shower now. Now the whole world knows you're naked. Shoo! okay, and all right. Pardon the interruption, folks. Every now and again, you got to be a parent. And, of course, Walsh came back with a follow-up tweet after getting so much criticism over his initial tweet and said, "Get real. I don't hope for another act of terror, but I know it will happen. And the appeasing cowards of CNN et al. Only endanger us all." He later tweeted that Islamists don't take orders from me, meaning they're not listening to me as to who to go after. Of course, if the Islamists were going to go after somebody, it sure wouldn't be somebody who didn't show the cover. That's just my opinion, folks. I don't know if that's the way Walsh feels. Now, HuffPo's Michael Calderon reports that the New York Times is the only top U.S. newspaper not to publish the cover. CNN, ABC, NBC, and the AP were all among those who didn't publish the cover, however. So anyway, just a lot going on with regards to the aftermath of that tragic Islamic terrorist attack, and both here and abroad. Switching over to Capitol Hill, some good news for Barack Obama, of course. The president's approval ratings, they are on the rise as Americans' view of the economy improves. Of course, we heard the report yesterday that retail sales were down in their biggest drop since 2011. That was for the month of December. So I'm not really sure how much better people think the economy is, but consumer confidence is up as of Christmas. So that's all good news. But that had, of course, a positive effect on Obama's job approval rating. It jumped 5 points to 47% since December, according to a new Pew Research Center survey, while his disapproval rating stayed high at 48%. Now, as you know, last January, Obama's approval rating was 43%, and his numbers have lingered in the low 40s throughout most of 2014. So, of course, this is good news for Obama. Of course, I said this not on the radio show because the radio show hadn't started yet, but I said this way back when, as soon as the Smurfs took control of the House and the Senate, that Obama's approval ratings would go up, because it's an easy thing to do when you don't matter anymore. I mean, he's in the Oval Office. He's writing his anybody can write executive orders, and anybody can direct their agencies to increase rules and stuff like that. But he doesn't have to push legislation through anymore. You know, we have given him now. Well, in 2012, we gave him more of what's that word he used? Oh, yeah, flexibility. And in 2014, of course, we highly curtailed his flexibility. And so he doesn't have a whole lot to do. His approval ratings are going to continue to rise. And, of course, that'll depend. Now, I'm going to tell you, if the Elmos take my advice and continue to pass legislation like it looks like they're going to do, even though there's threat after threat after threat of a veto, those vetoes could seriously have a seriously negative impact on Obama's approval ratings. You heard that here, folks. There's some people that are cheering Obama on. Of course, those are his army of Obots, to veto everything that the Republicans do. It's kind of funny, isn't it? The Elmos had just one chamber of commerce. I mean, one chamber of commerce. One chamber of Congress. And the Smurfs were all up in arms about how they obstructed every single thing Obama wanted to do. Not exactly true, by the way, but they were the obstructionists with a single chamber of Congress. Now, here's Obama. He doesn't have either chamber of Congress. Now, both chambers are elected by the people. They're not elected by electoral votes. That's not how we elect our Congress and our senators, even though senators used to be, about 100 years ago, elected by the state. They were sent by the state legislatures. Not true anymore, of course. The people elect their own senators and their own House of their own representatives in the House. But here's Obama. He doesn't have either House. And with a simple veto, he's going to veto everything that the Republicans do. And there may be some things that he won't veto, but these guys have been at such odds for so long that every time something happens in an election, they, for show, say, of course, we're going to try and reach across the aisle. Now, I am a little bit impressed with the Elmos reaching across the aisle, allowing debate on the Senate floor and allowing amendments from the minority party. Keep in mind, the Smurfs are as big a minority in the Senate as the Elmos were not just a couple of months ago, or actually in December. So this is an interesting shift, if you will, and something that the Elmos need to advertise. Because they're not going to get it from a lot of the press. But anyway, Obama's approval numbers are up. Improving views of the president come as sentiments about the economy are also improving, so they kind of go hand in hand. For the first time in 5 years, more Americans said Obama's economic policies have made things better rather than worse. It's so funny that almost changes with the wind as to how people feel, 38% versus 28%. So in other words, 38% now say that Obama's economic policies have made things better rather than worse. So that's up from 28%, but it's still well below a majority of the American people. Moving on, the Obama administration has unveiled new methane emissions rules. This is an interesting concept. Of course, I've said all along that if you want to do something about climate control, you don't want to mess with, you want to do methane and you want to do water vapors in the air. Those are they have the most impact on heating the atmosphere and raising temperatures, far more than carbon emissions ever could. But of course, they're not plugging up cows, so they stop their flatulence. They're actually going after business, of course. It's not a real bad thing to control the emissions from certain business endeavors and industries and stuff. But the Obama administration, their new strategy to cut methane emissions from oil and gas operations, it's too weak to meet even the White House's goals, let alone slow the change in the climate. So the critics are saying, you know, why bother, basically? The attack on methane is so weak, according to them. Of course, you know, so flip to the other side, and any attack on emissions is too much. This is probably just the way they play their side and their hand of cards to hopefully prod the administration to do more. But the plan was, and I thought they were pretty stringent when I read them, the plan was Barack Obama's latest executive action to combat climate change and follow the Environmental Protection Agency's initiatives to regulate power plants' emissions of carbon dioxide. dioxide, the most prevalent of heat-trapping gases. Not so, under a series of rules that are due to be finalized this summer. Given the requirements of the Clean Air Act, the new rules could open the door to future regulations of powerful greenhouse gases. But Wednesday's proposal mostly rely on voluntary efforts from oil and gas companies to reduce leaks of methane. And the main component, that's the main component, by the way, of natural gas. When they drill for natural gas, methane is emitted. There's also methane emissions coming from capped oil wells, that have been capped either because they were non-productive or because they were done extracting whatever oil that they thought they could get from that well. The energy industry's sand, oil, and gas producers are already working to eliminate leakage anyway, since that stray gas represents lost revenue for them. So if they can capture that gas, that's just more money in their pocket. And they contend that the new rules could threaten the boom that has made the U.S. the world's largest energy producer. Of course, that's what they're going to say. That's the flip side of the coin. You know, we want to protect the environment. But at the same, and we don't want to contribute in a harmful manner. But if these rules really are just not enough, then why bother? If they're not going to change the effects of climate impact, the impact on the climate, then why bother? It seems to me it's just a waste of time, effort, energy, and of course, money. Along with the series of planned steps laid out by the White House came a New Year's resolution style goal: cutting the oil and gas sector's methane emissions by 40% to 45% by 2025 from the 2012 levels. Now, this is what I thought I don't know how they can even say that's not enough, you know, that that's not good enough. I mean, that's almost half, not quite half. But it, of course, it wasn't clear how that reduction could be reached, since most of the methane that escapes from wells and the arteries that connect them to large pipelines would not be subject to the rules. So, again, there's some leaks in the plan to control leaks, if you will. All of this is interesting to me because there is so much evidence now that the climate is changing, whether it's caused by man's activity or whether it's a natural cycle of Mother Nature is immaterial at this point. There's so much evidence that that we passed the point of no return. This is going to happen no matter what we do, and we need to start looking at other ways for mankind to survive down the road. It's not going to really impact most of us in our lifetime. But down the road, we need to start looking at technological ways to further our species beyond the time when the climate changes and our own ability to adapt to those changes is eclipsed. We'll only be able to do it through technology. And that's something that we need to focus on. And there's been a lot of focus on that. I don't know if y'all have ever done any research on that, but there's been a tremendous amount of focus on technology that could help shield the human race, as well as other species, from the damaging effects of global warming. In any case, that's some interesting stuff. We're going to turn to some presidential politics now. But before we do, let me remind everyone that when it comes to mattresses and bedding, David Ritter and his staff at Choice Mattress and Furniture know their stuff. My whole family is now sleeping in beds from Choice Mattress. You cannot say enough about the benefits of a great night's sleep on the right mattress for you. Every mattress carried by Choice Mattress comes with a 5, 10, and even 15-year 100% full replacement warranty, not a prorated limited warranty like the other stores. With over 20 years experience, David knows beds. And check out all the other fine lines of furniture Choice Mattress has for every room in your home. Go see David and the fine folks at Choice Mattress and Furniture, located on the corner of LPGA and Nova Road, 1501 North Nova Road in Holly Hill. If you just have questions, David is always happy to answer them. You just got to give him a call at 386-226-BEDS. That's 386-226-2337. Choice Mattress, simply the best choice that you can make in your sleep. Turning back to presidential politics, interesting poll out today. Only 4 in 10 people want to see a woman president. That doesn't bode well for Hillary. Of course, you know, it's still well before the 2016 elections. But fewer than 4 in 10 Americans said it's important to see a woman become president in their lifetime, with more Democrats, of course, than Republicans saying they want a woman in the Oval Office, a survey released Tuesday had found. It's a Pew Research Center study. 16% of Republican men surveyed in the gender in politics and business say it matters to them to see a woman become president of the United States, while 20% of Republican women said they support the same. That's, of course, going to be compared to 46% of Democrat men and 69% of Democrat women who identify with the party saying they want to see a woman elected. Now, I mean, I got to say, there's just, man, I don't know. I mean, 46% of Democrat men, I wonder how many men that are Democrats say that because they feel like that's what they're supposed to say, as opposed to that's how they really feel. Of course, 20% of now, remember, this question is not, do you want one, or disagree that a woman should ever be president. It was simply, is it important to you that it happen in your lifetime? And of course, the obvious question to me is, it's not important to me whether a woman per se become president. It's important to me that the right woman become a president. And if she's a better candidate than any other candidate, man or woman, that is running. So I'm not voting for a woman just because she's a woman. I would vote for a woman like Elizabeth Warren because she is what every other Democrat pretends to be. Every Smurf pretends to be against Wall Street and for Main Street. Elizabeth Warren doesn't just talk the talk. She walks the walk, unlike Hillary. But unfortunately for you Smurfs, apparently Elizabeth Warren is not going to be running for president, and therefore the wrong woman is running, and she won't get my vote. Hillary Clinton is just an establishment politician, and so as far as she goes, she basically talks the talk but doesn't walk the walk. She's very in with Wall Street, and that's not necessarily a bad thing until you start saying things like, "Don't let these corporations and businesses tell you that they create jobs." She's out of her mind saying stuff like that. And not only that, she's just flat dead wrong. So, but in any case, in all, 38% of Americans said they hope that a woman is elected in their lifetime, while 57% say it doesn't matter. Now, women still struggle with being perceived as electable. Pew found that with 58% of men and 73% of women surveyed saying it's easier for men to get elected into office. Now, I don't know about politics, folks, but I got to tell you, I have worked in places. I've worked for woman bosses. There was nobody more trying to bite that boss in the back than women. It was something that was kind of surprising to me the first time I saw it, because I would think that women would be in support of women, that a woman would actually have more women on their staff than men, and it just simply did not turn out to be the case in my experience. And I've worked for about three or four women bosses over my years. So interesting that women would feel like it's easier for men to get elected to office than more women felt that way than men. Well, that's not actually true. Or that's not actually that surprising to me. I mean, women do think they're disadvantaged, that's for sure. But 58% of men and 73% of women say it's easier for a man to get elected to office. But quite frankly, I think that's got a lot to do with numbers. More men run than do women. I think that women are very skilled, that's for sure, in a lot of areas, especially leadership. And the survey did also touch on that as well. So very interesting survey coming from the Pew Research Center there on women in politics, particularly presidential politics. Now, Jeb Bush, of course, you know, he's somebody that I'm intrigued by. He was a fantastic governor here in the state of Florida. And by that, I mean he was a good education governor. There are Smurfs here in the state of Florida that say he was the best environmental governor that this state ever had. He is just conservative enough to win the nomination from the Elmos, and he's just centered enough to win the general election. But I'll tell you this, even more so, I'm going to say this. Here's one thing that Jeb Bush has, especially over Mitt Romney, who has flip-flopped from one issue to another depending on what type of political race he was running in. Jeb Bush does not waver. If you've knew Jeb Bush way back when he was governor, and then through the 10 to 12 years, 9 years, I think it was, that he was out of office, and now going into presidential politics, he'll listen to the opposing viewpoint. He'll take it into consideration, but he's not going to switch his position like Romney did, for example, pro choice to pro-life, you know, pro and back again, or whatever it is that he did, or on several other issues. Jeb Bush is not going to do that just so he can win a certain faction's votes. It's not going to happen. And that's something that's important, I think, in politics today. A lot of people talk about the flip-flop. I don't think you're going to see a whole lot of that from Jeb Bush, but he's going to D.C. because he's got to sew up some he's got to get in there and get some power brokers and sew up some bundlers for fundraising. And apparently the other guys that were in the race already have gotten the jump on him with regards to that. And, you know, if there's one criticism I would have of Jeb Bush, it would be that sometimes he's not aggressive enough. But, you know, the man knows how to pick his battles, because I've seen him be very aggressive in getting people on both sides of the aisle here in Florida to steer into his where he was leading the state. So very, very interesting character. I like Jeb Bush. He's nothing like his brother, and he's certainly not the cowboy type. And you're going to get a lot more discernment from him with regards to all the major issues that are important to everybody, from the economy to world diplomacy. So interesting character. Really like him a lot. We'll see what happens when he gets into this field of conservatives who can't wait, really, to rip him apart. I consider them a school of piranhas, even though a lot of them, you know, I don't have too much bad things to say about. Rand Paul, of course, is one of them. He looks to steal the spotlight here in 2016. That's an article in Politico today, where he hopes to appear eager to return to his role as conservative firebrand. And see, here's the guy who's softened up from conservative viewpoint, and then now he's wanting to go back to the conservative firebrand. And that's just the kind of thing you're not going to get from Jeb Bush. I don't think. I could be wrong. But anyway, Rand Paul called Jeb Bush a big government Republican. He reduced the government here in the state of Florida, by the way, while he was governor. Mitt Romney had his chance, according to Rand Paul. And even Mitt Romney felt that way at one point, said that his time has come and gone. Now he's apparently come again. And he said Marco Rubio's recent jabs on foreign policy are silly and childish. So he is trying to steal the limelight after having lost a lot of that limelight with Jeb Bush's announcement and Mitt Romney's reincarnation, I guess, if you will. His upgrade, they're calling it Mitt 3.0 for his third run. And, of course, Marco Rubio got quite a bit of stepping into the limelight when Obama came out with his immigration, his executive orders on immigration. He's also taken quite a few stands on Obama's approach to ISIS. So anyway, what Rand Paul says is that we need a candidate who reaches out to new constituencies and is able to bring people into the party. Because if we do the same old candidates, we're going to get the same old results. You know, it's just too funny because they attack people like Jeb Bush and Mitt Romney for being more to the center, which is actually supposedly going to attract more independents and people that lean, that don't necessarily vote the same for the same party in every election. They don't vote straight down the party ticket. But at the same time, he's saying that we want someone who's going to bring in lots of different people. Is that Rand Paul? I wonder. But anyway, he's got some very good positions that I feel good about. But he's really starting to lash out at the top guys, because he's, in my opinion, now stands probably fourth, if not fifth, behind these other guys. So it's time for him to make his move or step out of the race, or maybe that's the way he's thinking. Anyway, John Thune said there's no opening for a White House run for him. He is, of course, a Republican from South Dakota. He's ready to dive deeply into policy weeds as the chairman of the influential Commerce Committee while using his role as leader and the Senate GOP conference to pursue the party's unity. And all the while, he's watching three different Republican senators mull a run for the presidency. I got to tell you, folks, a real confession here. If it weren't for this article from Politico, I would have never known who John Thune is. Never heard that name before. I guess he's higher up in the Republican Party, but, you know, he's from South Dakota. I didn't even know people lived in South Dakota. If it weren't for fracking, I wouldn't think anyone would live there at all. So, just a surprising name to jump out here and say that there's no avenue for him to run for president. When we did our show on the presidential candidates, his name wasn't even in the list, and it was a huge list. So, he's always said that there's got to be an opening for a presidential bid, and he believes that his was gone in 2012. Well, it was gone for a lot of people, including Mitt Romney in 2012. So, interesting chiming in from a guy I never even knew existed. The Chamber of Commerce head has criticized the economic populist Elizabeth Warren, and he had some interesting things to say. The Chamber of Commerce charged on Wednesday that Elizabeth Warren and her other backers of what they call economic populism were actually seeking a state-run economy. It's an interesting take. I mean, because if you're going to continually regulate and regulate and regulate the economy in the name of fairness, I'm all for removing the advantages that the big guys get over their little guys, their up-and-coming competition that makes it hard for them and actually starves the little guys out, depriving them of the air and fertilizer that it takes to grow a business, especially in this economic climate. The more you over-regulate, the more that this statement might actually be true, a state-run economy. Thomas Donahue, the chamber's president and top business lobbyist, he said that he didn't think most Americans shared the views of Elizabeth Warren, who is, of course, a liberal Democrat and Wall Street critic. She's considered a possible presidential. You know, that's just the article adding whatever fluff they can add. She denied interest in running for the White House, of course. Today we're hearing a lot of talk, he went on to say, about so-called economic populism. It advocates the claim that they are standing up for the average citizen, but what they really stand for is the unbridled growth of central government and state-run economies. So that's an interesting take, because if you do overregulate, if you overdo it, and I don't know that it really calls for regulation as much as it does removing the advantages that K Street has lobbied for on behalf of just gigantic corporations that put every other potential competitor at an extreme disadvantage. I mean, I always refer to the ex-CEO of Home Depot and his claim that he could never build Home Depot in today's economic climate with all the disadvantages that are placed on an up-and-coming business, not in any way, shape, or form the way he did it back when he first built Home Depot. So, I mean, it's a pretty interesting concept. Overregulation, you know, is one thing, but you know who can't afford regulation is the little guys. It puts them out of business. You know, the big guys, they can afford the legal. Sometimes little businesses don't even realize they're violating a regulation because they don't even have the legal staff to get down to the bottom of what of what's actually required of them. So sometimes they just get in trouble, and fines can put them out of businesses, taxes can put them out of business. All of these things that big, huge corporations can afford to stand, at least for a good while, that little businesses that are operating either on a shoestring or with limited resources cannot overcome. You know, of course, big business would rather have no regulation, and big business would rather have lower taxes. But in the interim, knowing that those things are going to happen, knowing that they will starve out their competition, which would only increase market share for big corporations, is the next best thing. So that's something to keep in mind. The Medicare expansion is likely to contract. This is an article from Politico as well. After the midterms, there was a new assault on in some states over the Medicaid expansion as the Smurfs lost a lot of power both in the governorships and in the state legislatures. That is a danger for them because, of course, you know, the states have to vote to expand their Medicaid. They can also vote to unexpand their Medicaid, and they're not required to expand Medicaid as per the Supreme Court's ruling. A handful of Republican governors have said after the November elections they'd be open to taking billions of federal dollars to cover millions of their low-income residents under the Affordable Care Act Medicaid expansion. Instead, Medicaid faces possible retrenchment after the Republican tide, they call it, really a tsunami, swept emboldened Obamacare foes into every level of government. Arizona and Arkansas, for instance, the article says, seemed like the top trophies in the expansion push, but the governors who embraced that part of Obamacare are now gone, and hundreds and thousands of people could be stripped of their coverage if their successors don't show the same zeal to defend it. You know, and this is a very important thing that I want to point out. This is what happens when you come up with a new entitlement. Once you give it to people, this entitlement starts to weave its way into the fabric of society. And so that when you say, well, you know, we don't believe that was a good idea to begin with, and it wasn't, we still, it's hard to unravel that because, as I've said many, many times, once somebody is feeding at the public trough, they rarely want to give up their slop. You literally have to pull them from that teat in order to get that up, and that's going to generally cost you their vote. So the Republicans better be careful here, the Elmos better be careful, because you cannot leave these people in the lurch. You have to have some means of helping them. Now, these are not people that are without means. It's just when health insurance is so expensive, it's almost laughable to consider it as a priority. So you have to have something come into place to help these people. That may very well be the subsidies of Obamacare that help people from 100% to 133% of the poverty level to gain insurance through the exchanges. Of course, you know, even those subsidies in states that didn't do their own exchanges but had relied on healthcare.gov, those may be in jeopardy as well. So you're going to have a tough solution or a tough problem here that's going to have limited solutions. But just taking people off of healthcare, of course, I got to tell you too, you know, this needs to be said. Taking people off Medicaid is really not all that great a thing. They still do wait to go to the emergency room for non-emergency treatment. It's hard to find a doctor, folks. I mean, here where I live, people that try and find a doctor that's taking new Medicaid patients have to drive at least 45 minutes from where they live. Some have to go as much as an hour and a half to the nearest big metropolitan to find a doctor that's taking new Medicaid patients. And a lot of these people that are poor enough to get Medicaid, they don't have cars. So it's not like it's an easy thing for them to just plop an hour to an hour and a half to get cheaper treatment that would be cheaper on the system when it's easier for them to go 10 minutes to the nearest emergency room. So we need to bear that kind of thing in mind. It did not lower non-emergency visits to the ER. Obamacare did not lower that. It increased that. And the same thing is true of RomneyCare, which they say they modeled Obamacare after. Did not do that in Massachusetts either. Did not cut down, which was the goal, by the way. That was the whole reason that they did RomneyCare, was to lower the most expensive forms of treatment. And it didn't have that impact at all. So that's an interesting thing that we'll be having to watch and see what happens with those people that are going to be caught in that gap, if this happens, between poverty level and 133% of poverty level. The Secret Service has had a major shakeup. They reassigned four members of their management team, and this comes after the independent review was completed following the security lapses that led to the resignation of their director, Julia Pearson, in October. Change is necessary to gain a fresh perspective on how we conduct business, Interim Director Joseph Clancy said in a statement. I am certain any of our senior executives will be productive and valued assets, either in their positions at the Secret Service or the department. So finally, we're getting to do those fixes there. Kind of important. Needs to be taken care of. Barack Obama's broadband move stoked tension with the GOP. President is delving more deeply into broadband issues as he tries to put his stamp on the nation's internet policy, setting up more conflict with the congressional Republicans and telecom giants that dominate the industry. When Obama laid his plan out to boost community broadband networks in Cedar Falls, Iowa, on Wednesday, it marked the second time in two months that he's put his administration at the forefront of the debate over the future of the web. The president's late last year called for the FCC to treat broadband like a public utility as part of the new net neutrality rules. So this is something that's going to come to a head. I don't know if it's a real big priority for the Elmos at the moment, but we'll soon find out about that. The IRS service is degraded. Taxpayers are not going to get as the service that they need from the IRS, and around this time of year, that's very important to a lot of people. The taxpayers face being abandoned this tax season by the IRS grappling with the budget woes, according to a watchdog report released Wednesday. Well, you know what I'm going to say to that, folks. Time to get rid of the IRS, time to get rid of the current tax code anyway. I am all for the fair tax, but I would actually vote for any other alternative tax that reduces this Gestapo-type agency where you're guilty until you prove yourself innocent. I think it's one of the biggest violations of American freedom that there can be from a government agency. Anyway, as the nation's advocates for taxpayers, I feel compelled to speak up about the degradation of service provided by the IRS in all aspects of its work, primarily in the pre-filing and filing activities, but also in its enforcement activities. That was, of course, from National Taxpayer Advocate Nina Olson. She's been speaking up a lot lately, as a matter of fact. Over on Capitol Hill, Harry Reid is likely to return to the Senate next week, said a Democratic aide. Reid suffered broken facial bones and ribs. He's deserving of time off, as he is injured. He also suffered a concussion. This may fix his brain. I don't know. But anyway, he's coming back next week. So we will see. Conservatives, I hate it when they use that word for these people. The right-wingers' wish list for the GOP retreat includes citizenship and voting, voting bills. They want to make it easier for states to make rules with regards to voting. And, of course, they also want to end birthright citizenship, meaning if you were, I guess what they mean by that is when illegals come across the border and have a child, the child becomes a citizen and therefore they can stay because their child is a citizen. I'm not really sure what they mean by that, but anyway, these are all going to be right-wing wish lists, and I predict that the establishment of the Republican Party in the name of success in 2016, or with the goal of success in 2016, is going to nip a lot of this stuff in the bud be going for things that they can get through both chambers, and that when the president vetoes them, it just doesn't seem that there's a really good reason to do so, other than that he's opposed to the people's choice of who they placed in both houses of chamber. Both chambers of commerce. Why do I keep doing that? Both chambers of the Congress, folks. The House voted to roll back Obama's immigration actions, but this version of the Homeland Security spending bill has no hope of getting through the Senate. None. I don't know why they would pass this. The House Republicans mounted a furious assault on 4 years of Barack Obama's immigration policies on Wednesday, satisfying hardliners on the issue, but prompting resistance among some moderates, and certainly the party's leadership apparently has gone too far. The GOP-led chamber voted 236 to 191 to pass the legislation funding the Department of Homeland Security through the end of September. The measures attached would effectively kill the administration's efforts to unilaterally shield millions of undocumented immigrants from deportation. It would also thwart Obama's administration's enforcement policies that limited deportations of people who weren't criminals or serial immigration violators. But given the qualms of moderates in the Senate and the presidential veto threat, the all-out rollout doesn't stand a chance of becoming law. I don't mind if something doesn't have a chance of becoming law because of the veto. I do mind at this point, when the Elmos now hold both houses of the chamber, that the House will pass a bill that will not pass the Senate. If it can't pass the Senate, if they can't earn at least 6 Republican votes to hit that 60 margin that they need to pass the Senate, then that's a problem. And that's something that they better address at this convention of theirs in Hershey, Pennsylvania, because if they come out and they start passing bills that pass the House but don't pass the Senate, they are toast in 2016. And if they're toast in 2016, then I'm disappointed only because that is the only way that the Obama Express will never be able to put back on the tracks, because they can start pulling up the tracks. But the bottom line is, if they're going to do this kind of stuff, they are doomed to failure. And the only people that can really lose that chance for them, now that Elizabeth Warren is for all intents and purposes, not running for president, is to shoot themselves in the foot like this. And so they better address this particular issue. It doesn't matter that there's not a veto. There's no supermajority requirement for things to pass the House. It just has to pass by a majority of one vote. When it comes to a veto, of course, they'll need two-thirds vote. I don't care about that. If vetoes are successful, that's the whole point of the strategy. Bill after bill after bill that passes the people's Congress, both the House and the Senate, that the people put in place, send them to the president's desk. Bill after bill after bill, let him make a choice. Is he going to honor the people's wishes, or is he going to veto them because it's his my way or the highway approach that he has had ever since he won the presidency back in 2008. Nancy Pelosi named the first Muslim lawmaker to the House Intelligence Committee. I hope we don't hear a lot of flack about that. The man is an American. A senior Democrat aide said that Andre Carson of Indiana would be named in the coming days to a key national security-focused panel. Pelosi told lawmakers of the appointment during the members' weekly caucus meeting. Carson would be the first Muslim to serve on the committee and was the second Muslim to be elected to Congress. He already served on the Armed Service Committee and worked for the Department of Homeland Security's Fusion Center, clearinghouse establishment established by the federal government to streamline data sharing between the CIA, FBI, and other, and the NSA. The interesting thing here, this guy could bring a lot of insight into the minds of Islam. However, he's not of Middle Eastern descent. He's an American converted to Muslim. So that's something to watch. I hope there's not a lot of big brouhaha, stupid brouhaha over the fact that he's a Muslim on the that's been being put. Placed on the House Intelligence Committee. Increased taxes to stop defense cuts. That's an interesting concept. The new chairman of the House Armed Service Committee is taking a bold stand for a Republican and a fifth-generation Texan who represents one of the most conservative districts in the country. He's not ruling out tax hikes as part of a deal to avert sequestration for the Defense Department. Now, got to tell you, I don't mind if they do it this way. If they find a way to do both cuts and raise taxes in order to support our military, that's one thing. The bottom line here, though, is the military budget is too bloated. You've had Smurfs complain about it. You've had Elmos complaining about it. You've had the president himself complain about cuts to the military, even though he himself made cuts to the military. The bottom line here is we've got too much money going into other nations' coffers for their militaries. The budgets that other countries have for their own military is so small compared to their gross national product. They need to have their own military budgets. If other countries did that, then our military budget would shrink automatically. Instead, we are putting too much of our own money into defending other countries, and although it's good for us to help them defend themselves, they need to start anteing up, and there would be the cuts right there to our military. And then we've got to stop forcing the military to build weapons that they say are obsolete and they don't want and they didn't request. But a couple of those things with the increase in taxes for the military, and I'm all for it. That's a wrap for tonight's show, folks. It was a lot of fun. We covered a lot of ground. My pond will reopen tomorrow night at 8 p.m. Eastern, and every night Monday through Friday. I hope you'll join us. Check the website to see what's up. 1111broadcasting.com. That's the numerals. 1111broadcasting.com, and you can check out shows past, present, and future. I hope you'll join us tomorrow night at 8 p.m., and until then, by all means, do what you love and love what you do. Good night, everybody.